your African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
The people were speaking, but Maryland lawmakers seemingly have the final word as it passes in an overwhelming majority HB 14, SB 744, essentially crime bills for youth. What can the community do? Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle weighs in. When we think of police brutality, we immediately focus on the one-on-one street-level interactions between overzealous and racist police and Black individuals. However, what do we call it when higher branches of law enforcement and our Black leaders are the actors? The African People's Socialist Party's National Organization Director Chimurenga Waller will talk to us, reflecting on the 2022 government-sanctioned raid and arrest of Chairman Omali Yeshitela. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. My name is Denise Young and I'm your host for the second Wednesday edition of the show. In the same way that consistency is important as we move in different facets of liberation, so is continuity of our media in discussing issues. This morning, we will pick up the conversation we had a month ago with Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle about the state of Maryland's ill and misguided attempt to reform youth criminal justice. Good morning, Davon.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Okay, so just very quickly so that our listeners, our family out there can be reminded of who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been doing?
So my name is Davon Love. I'm Director of Public Policy and co-founder of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, grassroots think tank, revolutionary Pan-Africanist perspective and worldview. And that's important because in addition to that, you know, our work is really advocating for the interests of Black people. Local and state of Baltimore cities where we're based out of. We advocate on issues that affect folks in Maryland, Black people in Maryland, statewide. And so one of the many issues that we focus on is addressing the criminal justice system has done to people of African descent.
Okay. And so thank you for that. And so when we had you on last month, we were talking about, at that time, HB 14 and SB 744. Can you tell our audience just a reminder of what those bills entailed?
So essentially, what had been happening and really reaching its zenith, I would say, in 2023, there was an attempt, particularly by Sinclair Broadcasting, to put out media narratives that I think heightened people's sensitivity to the notion of, you know, violent crime, auto thefts and the like. And so what happened was that the political leadership in Annapolis, particularly we live in a state that's a Democratic Party stronghold. So Democratic Party leadership in this state got together and put together a bill that in many ways rolls back some of the juvenile justice reforms that took place in 2022. In the state of Maryland that looked at keeping young people, particularly, 10, 11, 12 year olds out of the criminal justice system, because Maryland had been ranked nationally as one of the states that is the biggest violator of the rights of children, that incarcerates the largest percentage of its Black population, that I think every state in the United States except for one. And so really what the Democratic Party leadership did was put together a legislative package that rolled back some of the progress that's been made. Now, one of the biggest aspects of the policy that was put forward was expansion of the original jurisdiction of the Department of Juvenile Justice. For those who work with young people that come in contact with the juvenile justice system, it is often said that you want to do as much as possible on the front end to keep young people out of the system, and that interaction with the system should always be the last resort. So essentially, what the legislature did was expand the original jurisdiction of Department of Juvenile Services such that it shrinks the capacity for the kind of diversion that those that work with young people say is it creates the best outcomes for young people.
So I think one of the things that I want to have you reiterate for our listeners, because I think that this is one of the most critical elements of this conversation, and that is that we are talking about the ability for groups and the criminal justice system to be able to divert 10, 11, and 12-year-olds. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. So essentially, you know, again, one of the things that Maryland has, you know, got a bad rap for in terms of its actual policy is the way that it deals with young people, particularly Black youth, and it being the largest percentage of its Black population incarcerated. And so there was an attempt a few years ago in 2022 to change policies that made it so that incarceration was not the first and primary response to young people in Maryland. What has happened, so that was 20, and that was a major accomplishment. Mm-hmm. That actually happened alongside of the passage of the Child Interrogation Protection Act. Mm-hmm. That was a piece of legislation that essentially mandates that when a law enforcement engages in a custodial interrogation of a young person, that their parent is notified and that they consult with an attorney first before they speak with law enforcement. So those two things happen at the same time. And the propaganda that I was talking about that was advanced by police, prosecutors, law enforcement establishment, Sinclair Broadcasting, that propaganda was to push back on both. So in mm-hmm. some ways, you know, some of the work that now my organization and many others throughout the state have done to try to protect the progress on juvenile justice. And so the Child Interrogation Protection Act, for the most part, has been protected. That's something that there was a desire to even roll that back. But what we got in this Maryland General Assembly were policies that, again, expanded the original jurisdiction of Department of Juvenile Service, among other things. I mean, one of the other things that it does is that, for instance, mandated that state's attorneys are notified when a young person offends, regardless of whether or not diversion was the activity that was taken in that individual instance. And one of the things that I want to say to your audience, because I think it's really important, you know, because I think we've seen, you know, people that are familiar with the Hondikia challenge and the way that they're around the country, you know, has, you know, led to a spike in auto thefts around the country. Nothing unique to Maryland. And when we think about the narratives that are most highly circulated, a part of what we're hearing and seeing is, you know, people heightening people's feeling of not being safe. And so part of what happens is that the kind of media narratives that I'm describing have caused the public to think that what's on the table is whether or not a young person should be held accountable if they commit a heinous act. And I want to say it's important for your audience to know that that's not what's on the table. So, for instance, when prosecutors bring up the rise in carjackings, the legislation that passed in 2022 does not stop a prosecutor or law enforcement from picking someone up for carjacking. Carjacking is a violent offense, and that was actually one of the things that was retained in 2022, is that young people can still be incarcerated for violent attacks. And so there's a question as to whether that, you know, is the best approach. But it's important for folks to know that the reforms that passed in 2022 did not impact the ability for young people that commit heinous acts to be able to held accountable. And one of the most important things that I think is important for the listeners to know is that what advocates like myself and others are saying is that as much as possible, we need to focus on building the infrastructure so that diversion is something that is more viable, that there's certain kinds of services and interventions that are more available to young people, so that when a young person comes in and you're making an individualized assessment of what to do within that case of that young person, that those resources are available so that that young person can get what they need. And a part of what is happening now is that the infrastructure to provide that is frayed. And that infrastructure has been frayed for a long time. And I would argue that that only comes up in situations where legislators and political leaders want to soften the blow of the kind of tough on crime policies they want to put forward. Like, I don't hear that much about the importance of investing in young people in the infrastructure in other contexts. But in this context, we hear about it because I think there's an awareness, at least, that the policies they're pursuing are along the same lines as the kinds of policies that have decimated Black communities as a result of the war on drugs.
One of the things that really strikes me about this conversation is when you talk about how this bill or this even this topic is not about the holding anyone accountable. Like, that's not being challenged, the issue of accountability, and particularly when we're talking about heinous crimes. However, due to the fear mongering that has happened, the fear mongering, the propaganda through very conservative media, I believe it's Fox and Sinclair Broadcasting. Yeah. So then my question becomes, where is our progressive media? Where is our Black media? Where is the media that is supposed to be helping to counter these narratives that are extremely conservative, that are, as far as I'm concerned, that are right wing, that are the kinds of things that will turn voters away from the Democratic Party? Like, where is that media?
I think that's a very good question. And I mean, that's a part of why I'm thankful for the opportunity to be on your show this morning, is that, you know, in terms of, and I'll take them separately, in terms of progressive media, you know, particularly when it comes to local and regional matters, I find left and progressive media to not really be checked in to these kinds of efforts. You know, I'll see there's a lot more focus on some of the national politics, which, you know, quite frankly, from my perspective, is a little easier to cover. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, but I think, you know, in some ways for me, this is a challenge to progressive media to say that, like, on these kinds of issues, that people say, and there are lots of people in Maryland who are engaged in a national dialogue around some of these issues. And so I think it would be really helpful for there to be more focus, especially given, you know, the kind of right wing turn on these issues that the state has taken over the past couple of years. And then in terms of Black media, it's mixed. I mean, I would argue one of the challenges that we face is that legislators get information from political consulting companies and polling companies who describe the more right-wing perspective on issues of public safety and criminal justice to pull high amongst Black people. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I would argue that I would say it's been pretty mixed. Like, you know, there are Black venues that have given LBS an opportunity to talk about this issue. But again, I would say ideologically, it's fairly mixed in terms of the kinds of perspectives that are usually allowed, you know, on those kind of platforms. And I would even say that amongst our community, it's pretty mixed. I was actually watching, I may have mentioned this last time, I was rewatching a clip from the 2016 presidential election where Bobby Rush on MSNBC is apologizing for his vote, saying he was ashamed of his vote on the 94 crime bill. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're in a moment now where, you know, I think the fear mongering has created an environment where a lot of Black folks are just very mixed on the issue. I think there's an internalization of notions of racism and white supremacy that I think, you know, the same kind of criminalization that white society projects onto us, I think many of us have internalized, and I think there's work to do in our own community about pushing back against that tendency.
Yeah. So let's linger on that point just a little bit, because that was a real point of contention, you know, this idea of criminality within the Black community. That was a real point of contention in the most recent mayoral election in Chicago, where a lot of the influencers were able to, based on that, and based on what they were hearing from their constituencies about this idea of feeling safe in their neighborhoods, where they endorsed Vallis over over Johnson. And so when we consider this idea of, the Black community wanting to be safe, one, we want to be safe just like everyone else. But two, I think a big part of the what's been missing in the conversation is that a part of the reason that we have not been safe is, as you said earlier, has so much to do with the infrastructure and what has been stripped in terms of resources from our community, what we've internalized about ourselves. When you were on our show the last time, we had Brother Kevin Satterfield, and one of the things that he mentioned is that white supremacy is really strangling us, and yet at the same time, Black folks are showing I won't call it a similar hate, but that we are certainly showing a disdain for one another, and it manifests in so many different ways. So let's talk about that idea of this internalization and the mixed conversations that we're having in the Black community. What does that internal work begin to look like?
Well, I think that when we look at the post civil rights era, where Black people have been able to gain more entry into the so-called middle class in a way that was less possible prior to it. You think about the Kerner Commission established by President Johnson to do kind of a sociological study over time to track the progress that Black folks have made. And one of the things that it concluded was that Black people, there's a larger middle class, about a fourth larger middle class, but the masses of Black people are poorer than they were then. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that so with that dynamic, you have Black people who are aspiring into the kind of American mainstream. And in many ways, culturally, one of the ways that Black people attempt to gain entry into the mainstream is social and cultural distance from the masses of Black people. That there's a way that the community, some people call it the hood or whatever you want to call it, there's a way that success is understood to equate directly to your distance from our community. And so it's created a context where it is easier to rag on, to disparage working class Black people. But in many ways, when you look at, Black folks that have integrated into or attempted to integrate into the mainstream, many of them individually may do well. But many of them, I would argue, have abandoned the larger community. And so it's hard. So for me, I actually get frustrated when I see some of the discourses from elements of the Black middle class that disparage what they see in, cities like Baltimore, D.C. or Chicago. Because I think it's important to recognize that they benefited individually from freedom struggles that were aimed at helping the whole of our community. But they, I think, it's diverse. So I don't want to, make an overly broad statement. Yeah. But there are many people who have benefited individually from freedom struggles that were supposed to lift up all of us and have decided to look out more for themselves and a larger community. And so the way that I put it is that they don't have a right to moralize on what is happening. And working class Black environments that are dealing with the challenges associated with urban America, if they haven't in meaningful ways lifted up their hand to try to help and support folks in the community. And we should expect that in communities dealing with those challenges, that folks are going to carry guns, get in heightened conflicts, engage in property crimes, the kinds of things that people do anywhere on the planet when conditions are what they are in communities like that we're talking about.
Absolutely. One of the things that you said which everything you say is, I just think is brilliant and so important to these conversations. But you said that we are seeing our people, particularly middle class folks, do this thing called social and cultural distancing. And let me tell you why I think that is so profound. Because oftentimes what we do is talk about it in terms of white proximity. And I think while they are very similar, I think that they are also different, and they have different implications behind them. Because you can do social and cultural distancing from your community, and that doesn't won't necessarily take you, you know, to the you know, closer to, you know, or assume this position of white proximity, but there is a particular intent in terms of social and cultural distancing, and it is a looking backwards at our community. And so what you've talked about is really this absence of Ubuntu. We no longer have that, where we are, we understand that I am because we are. So I know that you have a busy schedule this morning. And so I just want to ask you a couple of more questions. I so appreciate your time this morning. But I want to go back to Maryland, the state of Maryland, which has been touting itself as one of the most progressive states in the country. However, we understand historically that it has not been, particularly when we understand that the state of Maryland was one of the states that actually had breeding plantations to be able to supply forced labor to the lower southern states. And when you're talking about the stats with incarceration, particularly Black men, how are we to hold our legislators accountable when we understand that this is really that from a policy lens, that it does not match the reputation that it touts? There's just a total misalignment.
Yeah, I would say that there's a way that Maryland narrates itself as progressive, that it legitimately could on certain issues. I would argue that on issues that most impact Black people, and the two that I'll name is whether we're talking about the criminal justice system or investments and community control resources for Black people. Those are two places where, even though Maryland may be progressive in other contexts, are not progressive on these issues. And I would argue that that is a broader question of the American polity, where when we talk about Black people practicing freedom, Black people practicing self-determination, that the weaponization of the criminal justice system against our community and the lack of access to resources that Black people control and the criminalization of Black people's access to resources, there's a way that those issues uniquely make Maryland, I would argue, a purple state. And I would argue the extent to which we saw a two-term Republican governor and Larry Hogan, I would argue he was able and his campaign was able to identify a strong level of convergence of overlap between a big element of the Maryland Democratic Party, right, and the conservatives. And I would argue the propaganda we're seeing from Sinclair Broadcasting is taking advantage of that overlap, where there is strong overlap between right-wing impulses, particularly around criminalizing Black people, and the Democratic Party in Maryland.
Okay, and then final question. Is there anything that our communities, I know you and other organizations, community members, were working so hard to be able to not have this bill pass? Is this what we're living with? Are there next steps? Is there a part two?
So unfortunately, the bill will pass. Now, one thing I will say is that the bill has been significantly weakened, and the details of it, you know, we can come back another time. But the bill has been significantly weakened. And so I think that just shows the power being able to push back, you know, when these kind of things happen. So I think the bill has been weakened. A version of it will pass. And there's actually going to be a press conference tomorrow in Annapolis around 1:30 or so. I know my organization, ACLU of Maryland, Racial Justice Now, and others are going to be speaking and pulling together a press conference to talk about the implications of the legislation. So I'll make sure I get you that information so you can give it, disseminate to your listeners.
Absolutely. Brother Devon Love, we always appreciate you stopping by. Thank you so much for being a warrior in this beautiful struggle. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So at this time, we are going to take a station break. And when we come back, we will be interviewing the National Director of Organization, Chimurenga Waller of the African People's Socialist Party. You're listening to What's at Stake on WPFW, and we'll be right back after the station break.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org. Make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 15 to the 28th. The festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years' premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake on WPFW. So family, we're going to do just a little bit of a pivot on this conversation. So often when we're talking about police brutality, we limit that conversation to those street level interactions that you know, are so devastating and so destructive and traumatizing to our community. But what happens when we are looking at a larger law enforcement effort when it's targeting our Black leaders? And so today, this morning, we have the African People's Socialist Party's National Organization Director, Chimurenga Waller, who's going to talk about this, particularly in the context of Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the raid that happened on his home in 2022. Indio Waller, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning to you. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. And before we go any further, please extend a great good morning and hello and greetings to the chairman, both for myself personally, but also from the WPFW family.
Okay, I'll make sure I do that.
So, Indio Waller, just as a reminder for our listeners who, or for those who may know and already, but there are probably some who don't know. Can you please tell us what happened with the chairman in 2022?
Sure. And I think it's necessary to give it some context.
Yes.
First, the chairman is the founder, and he's the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. He founded the African People's Socialist Party in 1972, in May of 1972. However, he had been a longtime activist even back in the 60s, and in 1966, December 29th, 1966, he pulled a racist mural off the wall of Sealy mm-hmm. Hall in St. Petersburg, Florida, and started the modern civil rights movement in the city of St. Petersburg. And he just has a long history of fighting for African people and fighting for the liberation of African people. That's just one thing. The organization, the African People's Socialist Party, has been involved in struggles to free Pitts and Lee, two black men on death row for 12 years back in the 70s. And we hounded the governor of Florida until they were freed. So the freedom of Desi Woods, who was charged with killing a white man with his own gun after he tried to rape her. And we fought for her freedom and made that an international case. And I think that is necessary to kind of give it some context. The chairman is just not somebody who the FBI decided to raid his house on July 29th of 2022. By the way, not only was his house raided, his house in St. Petersburg was raided. House in St. Louis was raided.
Yes.
Our Solidarity Center in St. Louis was broken into, and also the office that we have in St. Petersburg, Florida. So it was a two-city raid, two different states, and of course the chairman was threatened with automatic weapons, and they demanded this happened at 5 o'clock in the morning in St. Louis, Missouri. Where they demanded that he come out with his hands up. Him and his wife were handcuffed and held for a couple of hours. They invaded the Uhura house, took out boxes and boxes of files from some more than 20 years old, and they actually occupied the Uhura house for more than 8 hours in St. Petersburg, Florida. So this was... Of course, the FBI has a long history of this kind of activity against black people, killing black people on a regular basis. Of course, in Oakland, Lil Bobby B. Hutton killed by the police. And I know some people will say, well, that's the police and that's the FBI, but all of them are the police. And, the FBI is just the federal police. And sometimes they act in a more clandestine method, but this was an outright military assault that they carried out on July 29th. The chairman was identified as an unindicted co-conspirator along with three other members of the Uhura movement, two Solidarity people, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, and also our agitation and propaganda director, Akile Anai. She was also identified as an unindicted co-conspirator. In 2023, in April of 2023, the U.S. government, on the most flimsy and frame-up charges, charged Chairman O'Malley, Penny Hess, and Jesse Neville with failure to register as foreign agents of Russia. And conspiracy. And this ridiculous charge is still pending. They have set it for trial in September 3rd of this year. However, we have filed a motion to dismiss that was filed on last year. They had oral arguments on that motion to dismiss last September, and it still hasn't been decided on yet. A magistrate judge recommended that it be denied. However, the trial judge still hasn't ruled on our motion to dismiss. So, we're not laying all our hopes that that's going to happen. We're fighting vigorously every day in the political realm to let everybody know about these charges, how ridiculous it is. All of a sudden, they are alleging that the chairman, after all these years of being a leader, is now following directions of the Russians, and this is just a ridiculous charge. But it's a charge that is meant to attack not only the African People's Socialist Party, but free speech in general, and certainly the African Liberation Movement in particular.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Indio Waller. One of the things that strikes me, and I've heard these events from people from within your organization, including Chairman O'Malley, and I have to say that it is no less traumatizing to hear it now than when I heard it the first time. Why do you think that these events have not gotten more coverage in our media? Why is it that more people within our community don't know about this? Or is it that we know about it and we're being, it's, you know, almost like a facade that we don't know about it to discourage us from wanting to do anything about it?
Well, of course, one reason is that the media, while it was an initial splash, so to speak, and even the FBI was bragging as they handcuffed the chairman and tried to get him to sit down on the curb, which he refused to do. As they did that, they were also saying, oh, this is going to be on television. So they were bragging about how it would be on television. I think the media has, through the efforts of the FBI, have certainly made sure that that this is not something that's going to be heard by anybody, really. So it is up to the people of the other organizations to get be informed about what's happening. The African People's Socialist Party has been around for a very long time, and it's something that is not new to the African Liberation Movement. These whole charges is just ridiculous that they would even charge the chairman with something that we have been doing for years and years, traveling all over the world. What they're charging us with is speech. Just saying speech, making speeches, going to conferences, speaking on behalf of the African Liberation Movement and the African nation is now a crime. And this is ridiculous, and we have to fight back, and that's exactly what we've been doing. We've had dozens of webinars, and we raised almost $260,000 in legal fees. Of course, that money could have been going to the many programs that we have in St. Louis, where we're building a program for African women, a birthing center. We're building we also already have our Uhura House there. We've also built across the street from the Uhura House. We have a community garden. We have a little event space. But we have more than 14 properties on the same street in one of the most depressed communities in the city of St. Louis. That's why they attacked us. That's why. Because they don't want to see black people have self-determination. And we've spent more than 50 years as an organization trying to do just that, bring self-determination through revolution to African people. And that's something the government just won't not allow without a fight. So that's why we got attacked.
When you talked about the FBI as, you know, quotes, as being the police, are we really looking at these kinds of situations, or should we be looking at them any differently than we do when we see police interactions that result in the brutality and the killings of community members? Is there a fundamental difference? Should we be treating it the same way? What should be our response?
Well, there's no fundamental difference. As a matter of fact, I think it's important to note that many times the FBI and federal agencies are operating in local communities. Sometimes it's part of task forces. I know they have in the city of St. Petersburg, and I know that they've done that in other places as well. So is it a fundamental difference between them? Well, it's a difference in the way they function in terms of the federal government, of course, has jurisdiction in all 50 states. And as a matter of fact, they go outside of the United States. So I think it's important to note that... it's important to note that, you know, many times they operate on a local basis, but it's something that, you know, they still act as a standing army. And they are sometimes the federal government, by the way the FBI works, even outside of the United States. So it's an international secret police of the United States government. Of course, among, you see, literally at least 11 law enforcement agencies and military agencies in the United States. So along with 400 and something more than 400 and some local police agencies all over this country. So there's many, many local police agencies, and there's only one way to describe that. That's a standing army. So in the black community, while the crime, the so-called crime, is happening in the white community, most of the police are located in the black community where we live.
So in essence, we're being over-policed as our communities are under-resourced, as we are being criminalized for being poor, and not having the various infrastructures and interventions and resources that we would have, you know, had they not been, you know, very ceremoniously stripped from us through through, you know, codified methods. One of the things that also is, I think, very telling about what is happening with Chairman O'Malley is that you mentioned also about particularly the solidarity movement or component of the Uhuru movement being targeted. Can you tell our listeners and our family out there what that solidarity movement is exactly?
Yes. In 1976, the African People's Socialist Party and Chairman O'Malley Chintela initiated the effort to build the African People's Solidarity Committee. This would be different from other left organizations in this country in that it is directly under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. So they take direction from us, and what we believe is they act as a African liberation movement in the white community behind enemy lines, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So they do, their job is to raise reparations for the African liberation movement, and that's exactly what they do. Having that force behind enemy lines is really important, because now all the voices of anti-revolution, anti-African revolution, those voices are being challenged by the presence of the African People's Solidarity Committee and the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, which are both organizations in the Uhuru movement and under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party.
Okay, and when we're being targeted, is it safe to say that there is something that is going on, something that we are getting closer to, whether it is our liberation, whether it is self-determination? What are the things that keep law enforcement at every level targeting Black people?
Well, I think this is clearly a sign of weakness on their part, not a sign of strength. That's why they come with all their armored cars and automatic weapons mm-hmm. to make it appear that it's a sign of strength, but it's not. Mm-hmm. In St. Pete, it was interesting to note that the local police, by the way, were the ones who cordoned off the neighborhood so that the FBI could do their dirty work and steal our files and steal our computers and steal our flash, our hard drives. So I think that it's something that's, they are in many, many places that we don't recognize they are. Mm-hmm. For example, they also monitor the internet. So when people get on TikTok and get on Facebook and get on Instagram doing videos, saying certain things, they should realize we are being monitored. We are being surveilled. So it's not, you know, they call those things free, but they're not free of surveillance. So we have to fight back as a community, and the vehicle for that, of course, is revolutionary organizations like the African People's Socialist Party. And when we say revolution, we mean the total liberation of African people. So we will have self-determination, total unity of uniting of Africa and an all-African socialist government. So that's our ultimate aim. And we fight that from different locations all over the world. We feel like we must have an international organization. So we're in a number of places all over the world, in Europe, the Caribbean, on the continent of Africa itself. And we believe that's the way that we're going to win this thing and end the oppression of African people forever.
When we're talking about the idea of liberation for African peoples, have we in this country, do we have a sense of, and when I say we in this country, I mean, you know, Black folks whose descendants were forced here in America. Do we have a real understanding, a real collective understanding of what that means and what that looks like?
Well, I think that's a great question, because there's a reason that we feel it necessary to build an international organization with locations all over the world. That has to be because it's one struggle. It's one nation that we are fighting for. So, you know, they give us false identities and identify us as African Americans and you're Jamaican American, and mm-hmm. but we're one nation. The mm-hmm. enemy cannot define who we are, but that's exactly what they've done. They define who we are and define who they are as well. But what we have happening now is a struggle between nations. The African nation is fighting the European nation And when I say the nation, I don't mean all the people. I mean the actual state, because the state is the armed forces, the police, the schools, not just the armed forces, but schools, judges, the courts, all of that encompasses the state. That state must be defeated for African people to have their freedom. Of course, the state exists in many, many different places. We have to be in many, many different places. Everywhere where Black people live, they live under the conditions of either neocolonialism or colonialism, where a foreign power is in charge of our lives, every part of our lives. The education we get is colonial education. The courts we go to, those are colonial courts that lock us up and continually put more people in Africans in jail than they educate. So we know that we are up against a powerful enemy, but it's being weakened every day through the struggles of the Palestinian people, the African people, continuing struggles, even though the native people have been decimated. Warriors like Leonard Peltier, we're certainly demanding the freedom of Leonard Peltier, who's been locked up after the Pan-Ruiz struggles back in the 70s. He was accused of killing an FBI agent, but he has been locked up for more than 46 years. So we have unity with those oppressed people and colonized people. The native people are victims of settler colonialism. The white people came here and called it America and killed almost all the Indians and now throw them on reservations that are actually concentration camps. So you know, we have some very logical kind of allies that will certainly be part of this struggle for African liberation.
India Waller, we have 2 minutes left, but
okay.
System that is arresting and killing our Black children in the streets are the same ones that are warehousing them and putting them in a pipeline or to prison or enforcing corporal punishment. So I think that is, and I hope that our listeners and our listening family really, really grasp that concept. But I would be remiss if I did not ask you, how can our listeners support Chairman Yeshiteli and the Uhuru movement as it continues to go through these legal battles?
Great question. You can go to handsoffuhuru.org and you can make a donation. You can become part of one of the working groups inside the Hands Off Uhuru movement, we believe even if you have an organization, you can become part of the anti-colonial free speech movement, which Hands Off Uhuru organization started. You can go to the African People's Socialist Party website, APSPUhuru.org, or you can give us a call right here in St. Pete at 727-914-3617. So those are three ways you can get in touch, and I would encourage people to look at the website for Black Power Blueprint. You can see all the projects that we have on the ground and upcoming projects. Our Uhuru Pies Project, where we sell pies on a regular basis to raise money for our movement. We have more than I mentioned, we have more than 14 pieces of property that we bought in one of the most depressed areas of St. Louis. And we're really turning that community around. We put our Uhuru house there. We're going to have our Uhuru foods on West Florissant as well. So, APSPUhuru.org and handsoffuhuru.org.
Indio Waller, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an absolute privilege to talk with you this morning. Well, What's at Stake listeners, thank you for joining us this morning. And thank you to our guest, Davon Love, of the Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. And again, Indio Chimaringa Waller of the African People's Socialist Party. Thank you to executive producer, Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. Thank you. I'm Denise Young. May we continue to be truth seekers, and may we continue to fight for liberation. Stay tuned for our next show, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams.
Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or a daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Sego, this is John Cain, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Cain.
Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 15 to the 28th. The festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Economic, political, and military decisions in Washington, D.C. impact this entire country and world. And yet corporate media offers few facts, history, or people's voices about these important issues impacting our lives. I'm Esther Ivarum. Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, here on WPFW 89.3, Fridays at 10 a.m. We cover local, national, and international social justice activism, including those who come to D.C. from across the nation or from across the world to speak truth to power. Whether it's the war machine, climate change, the movement for black lives, healthcare, education, the economy, housing, voting, corporate power, immigration, criminal justice, or environmental justice. Check out On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, Fridays at 10 a.m. here on your station for jazz and justice.
Do you have a car that you're not using anymore? Help your community radio station by donating your used vehicle to WPFW, where it will be sold at auction, and the proceeds will help keep your favorite jazz and justice station alive and running. The benefit?